idea for the art fair is that it'll eventually start to move up and down the ballot and draw people in. The idea of this panel was just to look at, in a broad fashion, kind of where arts are in the Hudson Valley, which and where they might be going. And it's a very broad question topic to deal with, which is why we sort of have a broad panel that encompasses a lot of different aspects of the arts up here. Unfortunately, it's accidental that we came out in this gender configuration, but Christina will more than make up for
it. We've got a couple girls covered. No problem.
Just to run over who's here, we have Tom Rowe down at the end, who will also be live broadcasting today on the web, and it will be available on what is it? It's free103.9.org, which is the entity that you've been running for 11 years, you say. And Tom also is has a group called Wave Farm, which is for the last 4 years has been settling into Greene County, and it's a collective, or it was a collective, and it's an institution dealing with the new media of transmission arts. There's also a visual arts component with a sculpture park, some video elements, but a lot of it is dealing with sound and radio and other newer forms that are, you know, as our arts continue to widen. And Tom also has been learning a lot about arts in the Hudson Valley and the community, ties in through the whole process of going through planning boards, which may pop in at some point. Norm Magnuson is a painter and sculptor and conceptual artist, and has one of the great websites around, funism.com. And Norm has a work back over there with the birch kind of surround on it. Norm is also known for doing the faux historical markers that have made their way around the area quite a bit. And you come out of advertising at some point, which I think brings a wonderful perspective to his work. Benjamin Crevelin is the president of the Dutchess County Arts Council, and his training is as an artist, grew up in a family of artisans, and is from the region, and has probably attended more art openings than most of us. Christina Varga is an artist whose work is in the American Visionary Museum.
American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore.
And is also a gallerist. She has the Varga Gallery in Woodstock, and has been doing the curating of the Muddy Cup Studios in Kingston, and has a weekly public access television show.
Arts, culture, and media variety show.
And Apocalypse Varga.
Yes.
And descended upon us all here in the Hudson Valley about 5-6 years ago.
Yes.
And then Brian Wallace is the curator at the Samuel Dorsky Museum of Art over at SUNY New Paltz. And before that had been at the Moore College of Art and Design in Philadelphia, and the Bellevue Art Museum in the state of Washington, and went through the Center for Curatorial Studies at Bard, so also has a long history in both the area.
Went through it.
Yes.
You get a little bonus.
And then Robert The, who is probably best known for his book arts, book guns in particular, which is a specific form all unto yourself.
Specific form of vandalism.
Yes. And has been doing some amazing things utilizing eBay and Amazon.com as a palette, basically, of late. And also is in the process of figuring out the combined weight of all the emails in the world. So we will find out.
That's cool.
Sparrow is a writer and poet, critic, used to lead tours of the East Village nightlife and art scene. He's also sort of our political expert on the panel, having, this is his fifth run for the presidency of the United States. So,
don't vote for me.
Yeah, I'm just going to kind of open it up and direct as best I can. I've got some questions here. We'll open it up to other questions as things go on. But in thinking of the Hudson Valley, instead of looking at it in terms of the artists here, or in terms of the region geographically, I just want to kind of ask, what defines our audience up here? How do you each look at an audience, both locally and who are you making art for?
Well, I have a question. How about this audience? And maybe you can raise your hands and hold them up for more than one category. Who's a member of the press? Who's an artist? Who's a collector? Who's a dealer? Who's a nonprofit art administrator? Who am I leaving out?
Who's here from New York City up for the weekend?
Hey, that's a good one.
Nice.
Huh. Who wishes that?
Who's ever purchased a work from a Hudson Valley art gallery?
Nice.
That's nice.
That's good.
Wow. That's good.
Yeah. Who is local to the area?
What means local?
Yeah. Or who was born in the area, raised in the area?
Interesting. Who's the guy in the orange shirt? You're very interesting. Oh, cool.
Every category he raises his hand.
Yeah, yeah.
Work right there.
Yeah, I know. Someone pointed it out earlier. Yeah. Well, that was interesting. So, I mean, there's a little snapshot of who's curious about the topic. I don't know what that means to me right off the bat, but...
Do we have any elected officials in the house?
Yes. I think what your question, who
is the audience? What makes up? What I want to get at is what makes up Hudson Valley art right now.
I think that it is the responsibility of the people putting out the shows to put something that draws people to the show, and whoever it is that you tailor your show to, or whatever it is, maybe not necessarily a theme. But whatever kind of publicity, wherever it is that you put it out, that's your audience. Whoever it is that finally makes their way into your gallery. Not just like the whole art scene, but who actually walks on in the door, looks around, has some wine, or just look. That is your audience, and it's not always the same audience for every show. Yeah. And I don't think it should be. I think that there should be a variety of things. And Norm and I were talking about this in the car ride up here, that it's really important that this Hudson Valley region not just have a particular kind of art scene, but it be considered a scene of multifarious types of art. Potters and video artists and installation artists and people that make crafts, jewelers and all that stuff, including painters and sculptors and musicians and all the other things. So Hudson Valley, I think, doesn't have a particular voice. It has a voice as a region that draws a lot of artists, art collectors, and art aficionados to the area. And that's what we are very fortunate to have, more so than Tampa, Florida, or any other, whatever.
Benjamin, Benjamin has just brought, he's brought with him copies of a new report from Harvey Seifter, which it was kind of an overview, an outside an outsider coming in and doing an overview, looking at the Hudson Valley art scene to find out kind of where things are. What have you found in terms of...
Yeah, a lot of the work that we do, and I have to say it's very interesting to be representing the nonprofit world in a commercial art setting. And I do think the art, the vision of the art scene is growing from just a nonprofit to sort of include the commercial industries. And one of the things, there's a group that just is starting in Ulster County called Community Creativity. She commissioned this report from a gentleman by the name of Harvey Seifter to do an economic, sort of a an environmental scan of the arts, specifically in Ulster County, but as it includes Dutchess County. And where we come in is because we provide art services for both Dutchess and Ulster County. And a lot of his work obviously was focused on the nonprofit sector, and a lot of what we know that is going on in the nonprofit sector, particularly in Ulster County, there are a lot of small and medium-sized organizations that have, due to a lack of a consistent, strong funding stream, tend to be underinvested, have very weak infrastructure. And another regional issue that comes in, and this is something we can talk about, but on a regional level, just in, not only in Ulster County, but there's a communications problem. And throughout the region and throughout all industries, both the art industry as well as the commercial industry, where there's no real center to the Hudson River Valley. We are made up of all these small cities and these great rural creative communities, but we're all, you know, being pulled in many, many different directions, and so there's not a lot of cohesion, not a lot of that's pulling us together. Communication mm-hmm. is not as strong as it could be. So those are some of the issues that I think we're facing. And another issue, particularly in terms of audience, is there are so many publications now. Small publications, large publications, so many radio stations, that one of the tricky things is when you're trying to, as a small arts organization or a small gallery, or even artist who wants to promote their own work, where do they invest in reaching out? How do they get the word out? How do you develop an audience when, you know, every time you want to sort of open your mouth, it costs you $1,000 or $750 or $1,200. So
I'd like to
I think that's
to
a
that.
Big challenge.
But yeah. Here, before speaking of that, though, I wanted to bring in Tom briefly with, because you're dealing with audience in terms of trying to set up a radio station and an online presence at the same time. So you're reaching several directions at once, aren't you?
Yeah, well, as our organization, you know, as always, not always, but since we've been web streaming, we're focused on two kinds of promotion, local and international. You know, telling people through our website and other websites that you can listen to this event that we're at right this moment, and you know, there could be someone listening right now. So there's that, and then there's also getting people to come out to an event in Greene County, which is a different kind of hurdle to cross. And one of the ways that we're not really approaching that topic, but we happen to have just applied for a full power FM license, and it seems like we're going to get one soon, and we're going to have a full power radio station that covers all of Greene and Columbia County and a little sliver of Albany County. And in the future, we're already sort of talking to some other stations in the valley. There's WRPI, WFMU has another station, about collaborating on next year. Annalia Lockwood is turning 70, and she's a Hudson Valley artist that works a lot with field recordings and environmental sounds, and there's going to be some 70th anniversary concerts for her. We're going to see if we can get some of these arts-oriented kind of radio stations to band together and share some coverage of this event, and in that way kind of solve some of these problems that you're starting to talk about, a central location for disseminating information.
And you've done a lot of work kind of just reaching out to people within the community, all the communities you're going to be touching.
Yeah, with the radio station, we've got to get a council together of different people because we it's going to be basically like a community radio station during the day, and then like late at night it's going to be this weird art radio station where almost anything can happen. Saturday afternoons are probably going to be a lot like that too, but during the week there's going to be radio shows about the environment, about agriculture, about hunting, about the school systems. We're getting the school systems involved so the kids can work on making radio themselves. So we've had to do an incredible amount of reaching out to different parts of the community that aren't really involved in the arts and try to bring them into what we're doing and see if we can work together on this kind of project.
So community outreach at the Dorsky. I mean, besides the curating, I mean, there's family days, and do they have an effect, or are they?
Well, we do. I mean, with the Dorsky has a couple of different audiences. One group that certainly thinks of itself as a major audience is the campus itself. Faculty, students are frequently invoked as a reason the museum is there. And as an audience for us to serve. Like a lot of university, college, art museums, it's a bit of a tricky dynamic. A lot of the service is provided in pretty sort of standard ways that, given university politics, which is a whole other topic, but the sort of devolution of responsibility onto adjunct faculty more and more tends to mean that a lot of our relationships with students are less than fulfilling for all of the parties involved. I mean, quite frankly, for the museum, for the faculty, and for the students, there are sort of set-piece things that happen, which it sure would be nice if they could be a lot more interesting, and it would be great to see the museum as a bridge between students and faculty and the community. At this point, that's a pretty tough row to hoe, given resources and so forth. So I mean, I don't want to let this go by without acknowledging that audience of people who sort of, you know, parachute in here to be students or to teach, and who spend or make certain amounts of money and do other things in the community, and then stay and then go for certain periods of time. It's an important community, and it's true of the other schools in the area. They tend to attract, retain, and then let go interesting and or problematic batches of people. I think it's a tricky audience for us, but that adjunct
system also provides a level of employment and connection into the local.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the interesting artists I've been made aware of happen to have adjunct gigs at SUNY or X, Y, or Z other college or university school in the area. The museum does the best job it can with its local community. We'll just sort of, you know, drop the P word, parking. This is something I hear about. I mean, you know, we all know what we're talking about. It's a nightmare to get to the museum and park. There's a sort of bizarre attitude on the part of college administrators where they sort of look upon outsiders with suspicion. Because of construction on the campus this summer, maps other than at the edges of the campus were placed around the campus this year to help people navigate these giant aluminum bridges and so forth that are the result of a lot of infrastructure work being done on the campus. And I heard from someone involved in this process that there was resistance to putting maps out there because if you're on the campus, you should already know where you're going, which seems ludicrous until you realize that this is the view put out by parts of the administration. So, you know, we have kind of a tough job. Now I feel like I'm apologizing for not having family days every weekend and so forth. But we do a lot of work with the help of artists whose work we show, with the help of people who have donated to the permanent collection, and with the help of a couple of partners. And I would list the Center for Photography in Woodstock, with whom we have a collecting relationship that brings people to us. It gets me and others at the museum exposed to artists and collectors and audiences. We work pretty closely with the college's own art ed department and the School of Education, and increasingly with other parts of the school.
Norm, as an artist kind of moved into the area in recent years, has it been this whole kind of mix of the organizations and the galleries that we've been talking, and these entities that create audiences that we've been talking about so far, has that fed your art making or provided any, how has it affected your role as a creator?
I don't think it has at all. I mean, I've got a bunch of different audiences in my mind, and when you ask that question, one of them is the people you just mentioned. It's the curator, and the art dealers, and they're sort of my audience, I count on to bring the audience I think you're talking about to my work. Apart from that, you know, I have other audiences for painting. I paint for a person I've always called the thoughtful viewer, somebody who will stop and give my work, you know, 5 seconds of thinking, what is this about? Mm-hmm. For the historical markers, they're part of a bigger project. I want to put it up and down the length of I-75, and then the audience would be anybody who pulls into one of the 50 rest areas up and down there. But in terms of changing the way I've looked at it, my audiences would be the same sort of wherever I lived, I feel.
Has the moving into the area had any effect on the art in any discernible way, or was it moving? Is it moving the way it was before moving in here?
It's moving the way it was. It's you know, when you said we were coming here to discuss sort of arts in the Hudson Valley, I thought, well, I don't know what that is. I'm just an artist who happens to live here. And then I thought about it more. I thought, well, you know, maybe I've always sort of been a Hudson Valley artist. My work deals with wildlife, and my frames tend to be rustic, maybe more sort of associated with the Adirondack style. But, you know, it feels like home for me, and that my work fits right in to, you know, where we live in the mountains and the woods and stuff. So.
Yeah, well, but relative to what? I mean, this is an incredibly, you know, cultured and spoiled and, you know, sort of conurbated area compared to, you know, true wilderness. There's very little that's wild about the Hudson River Valley.
Well,
I would
but you
throw out.
You've been to my house.
I have been to your house. Yes. It is. It's about like 16 minutes from Woodstock, and it's about 24 minutes from like the largest, you know, terraforming project on the East Coast.
But
other than the Tennessee River Valley, so I'm wondering, like, relative to what is it wild?
Well, for me, I live in the wilds. You know? I mean, it's behind my house is thousands and thousands of acres of woods that, you know, you go and you never see anybody. You don't see houses. You don't hear anything. And it's, you know, as wild as you can get around here, I guess.
Yeah.
But for me, who's always lived, I was raised in suburbs. Lived in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just as wild as it could possibly be. The bears tip over the garbage can.
Yeah.
You know, it's.
So, yeah, and so, I mean, yeah, don't get me wrong. I happen to like quite be interested in your work. I'm just wondering about this dynamic, and it seems like we're sort of struggling to maintain, on the one hand, that there is a discernible, regionable aesthetic. And on the other hand, we're sort of hearing that what we really need is to build up an infrastructure so people who are already here can come and buy whatever it might be, because we have to have a really diverse array of exhibitions to pick up on all these mini audiences and selling stuff.
Well, I don't think there is or could be a discernible regional aesthetic, nor would anybody really want that.
Is that something that did, I mean, but it seems, I mean, did it exist historically, or is that something that's just something that we learned to apply to the past at this point?
It's a handy marketing handle.
Yeah. I beg to differ.
Put it on a group. It's this. Then it's much easier to package and market to a wider audience. Mm-hmm. And it's. I don't think you can say it's this, but if you could, it might be useful.
Yeah.
Robert, your work is even kind of less tied to the natural world around us.
Well, I was just trying to think my relationship to the valley has more to do with the thrift stores and the library sales that I run around in. You know, I'll get inspired with some weird call to do something, and suddenly like a few weeks ago, I was looking for an encyclopedia volume to make a broom out of. So I went all the way out at the Olive Free Library And then I found a volume at the Salvation Army in Kingston. So I sort of work backwards through thrift stores. And by the time I get to a museum, it's sort of down the pike, frankly.
So in a way, the city has worked as sort of an extra, a richer, cheaper borough of New York.
Well, that's something that I think is important to address, because I lived in Lower East Side for many years, and it did shape my consciousness, which was already fairly warped before I landed there. But it crystallized it in a certain way, and it created a certain kind of self-consciousness about my work. I mean, I used to think I was an idiot, and now I still think that, but I think that there's a context for my idiocy that I wasn't aware of before I arrived in the Lower East Side. And I've imported that idiocy upstate. And in terms of integrating with it, it really has to do with the debris trail wherever I'm at. And I think that the difference between here and when I live in the Lower East Side is I would find books all over the street in the Lower East Side, and I don't see that so much here. I have to actually go and buy them.
I think that's a good point. New York City kind of subsidizes the arts in the Hudson Valley to a certain extent. A lot of us are from New York City. A lot of us still do projects in New York City. A lot of us make money from New York City in different ways. So I think, us at Wayfarer up in Greene County, our audience is, when we have large events, 20 to 30% of the people come up from New York City. So I think New York City is... I'd have to be in the conversation as,
yeah,
as part
well,
of
more
the
than that, I've been to something. I've been to a few things, and like there are people from all over the world. Mm-hmm. I felt that in some, I went to some performance there like a year or so ago, and it was like Japan, Germany, Berlin. I forget who. It felt like, gosh, I felt like I was in Europe. So it's pretty amazing, and the draw. I mean, you're out really pretty far away, even for me in Kingston. So that's quite cool. I mean, I have a question. How many people came here with the Dia first?
Came here what?
Today. Yeah, today. That's been a problem that I hear about, is that people just take the train and get off the Dia and they go back. And I think that while there's all this talk about regionalism, whenever I make work, I am trying to engage what I consider universal problems and universal things that annoy me to great intensity. And the whole exoskeleton of making this, sort of scene and stuff, every time I hear that kind of talk, it's sort of a recipe for making something really stupid and boring. Mm-hmm. It has to be internally driven by really hard self-critical problems. I think that artists that I really admire are extremely hard on themselves. And really trying to push the best, whatever that is.
Well, has that become, and Spiral, has it become easier the more the more like-minded people, the more people thinking of the hard questions have moved up here? Has that made it a more fertile ground?
My wife and I moved up from the East Village to Phoenicia. Phoenicia is kind of in the middle of the Catskills, where people get lost hiking and die in a rushing stream. And so we moved up in 98. And when we moved up there, people thought of Phoenicia, even the Phoenicians thought of Phoenicia as more or less like a kind of Wild West punch them out kind of town. And then gradually, like recently, the Mount Tremper Arts Center opened like a mile away, and there's like this, the woman does her choreography in Mount Tremper, tries it out there, then she goes to Lincoln Center, and then she performs it for real at Lincoln Center. So like suddenly we're like, or gradually we're like linked into like the absolute real art world. We didn't go there to sort of escape the world, precisely, but suddenly the world has chased us down, and I suppose this globalized art world that we live in, there's nowhere to escape. That's my thought.
Well, does this provide, as much as it's, as everybody who's up here is looking back at New York, is it also kind of a safe perch to look off into the rest of this strange country we live in? Mm-hmm. Do you find that working into your... You know, can you see farther from here than you can from New York, where you're cluttered with other art and other artists?
No, I wouldn't say so. Not farther, not shorter, just the same. I mean, I read all my news online, occasionally get the Times. I'm so involved with the world. I do feel physically, not intellectually, more removed from the rest of the world than when I lived in New York City. But in terms of, intellectually, I feel I'm just as close as ever.
And in terms of the internet, it's made it just much easier to not have to be in New York City all the time. You can virtually be there, you know. You can follow a lot of stuff that's going on there and a lot of stuff throughout the rest of the world. The whole world, you know, is flatter these days because of the internet. So I agree with you. It doesn't necessarily, you know, make us positioned better than we're near New York City. You're near New York City almost anywhere, kind of.
Christina, you can, I mean, with your gallery, you've been mixing quite a bit. And this was after years of, I mean, it was almost as if Woodstock had crystallized into something, and then you came in and kind of poured water on it.
One of the things that I had to learn how to do, because really there was no budget. I've never had a budget, you know. I've never had, like, funding or like, an amount that I could play with and then have an advertising budget and do all this sort of stuff. I had to be very renegade. Every month was, okay, what can I do to bring in money? How can I make it so that people are paying attention? What can I do to get people to not only come to Woodstock, but then walk the 3 blocks or 4 blocks or however much distance it is from the nexus of the center of town to, like, just, you know, like a 5-minute stroll? And people, really what it became was using the internet because it's free and building a mailing list. And I literally... And this started when I was in New York City, but I would literally spend hours just typing, getting, like, the art guides, taking out all the email addresses and just typing them into my mailing list. I'd spend hours and hours because I knew that I didn't have much to work with, so I had to use absolutely everything that was free and available to build my image and to create something that would make people want to come out to Woodstock or, you know, in the forest. You know, what the heck is going to make somebody want to come out to the forest? So you build a fabulous thing. And it involved lots of press releases, which I'm sure you've gotten over the years. I have a degree in journalism and communications. The press is free. Advertising is not free. Advertising is really expensive. And it's also a game of consistency. And if that's the way that you can go, if you have a museum or somebody or something that gives you a budget and you have, like, stuff to work with, then that's a good way to go to draw people's attention. You can place an ad in the Village Voice in New York City, but if you can't place an ad in the Village Voice in New York City, if you've added everybody's mailing list that you can find or email that is either at a museum or a collector or gone on to some crazy website or did something, you know, where people could start subscribing, that's the way that you can get people to this region. And I feel that this region, being wild and beautiful and amazing relative to New York City, which is stinky and smells like pee. And, you know, I mean, honestly, I love the city. I lived there for 8 years, but there's something slightly repulsive about it. And after 9/11, I couldn't stand it anymore. I was just like, oh, my God. You know, you wake up with your hands and fists. There's SWAT teams in the subway. There's all sorts of stuff going on, and it's still the cultural center of the world, you know, versus Dubai, where they're going to build whatever the hell they're going to build. They're just going to build a, you know. Yeah, and that's the thing. But everybody, this region is really about, to me, about the mountains, about being generous to people, not about being, like, you know, grunged out on whatever, East 6th Street and A, you know, trying to eat a falafel for, you know, the struggle, the city struggle. It's just a completely different place, and we're a completely different environment. We don't have to be metropolitan to sell art. We don't have to be right there. We can either use eBay or PayPal, or somebody can buy it on a credit card over the phone, or whatever, as long as you get people to look at it. and get people to be interested in it.
So these are all the factors kind of determining where we are as an art scene right now.
That's right.
We're talking about the schools and the internet making a change and people moving up and kind of being
getting out of the city
between the wilderness and outside of the city. What factors are going to kind of push where we go from here on in? Well, what do you see kind of coming in that's going to help or hurt or shift both the audience side, the showing of art, and the making of it? I mean, you know, the difficulties, you know, both of you are finding difficulties being without vehicles right now.
Well, I have a car, but I'll tell you one thing. When the price of gas went up, it really limited my ability or desire to get around. And I used to really drive around a lot. I mean, you know, it's only like jonesing for some book or something when I get out. But I mean, it's been a while since I've been down to Beacon. And that's a problem in this area, because things are spread out.
And that's going to hurt kind of the... I used to bounce between openings all over the place, and I'd see you at openings all over the place, and there's not as many people able to do that right now.
I think it would be nice if I was trying to get some sort of list together of people just sort of carpooling. I mean, I think that we can use these pressures to actually do things like share.
In terms of like regional... branding in a way for the arts, because I do think it's interesting that we were having a conversation about arts and then all of a sudden there's like a 5-minute detour about the environment, and I think that's very much what the Hudson Valley is.
Yes.
It's both this combination. But in terms of moving forward, I think we do have to look at audience. I don't think there's one set of audiences which lives 75 miles that way. But then there's another audience that lives 5 miles, 0.3 miles next door that I think we have to do a lot more work on cultivating, particularly in terms of buyers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's you know, hopefully that's a role that the colleges can play or that an arts council can play, is helping make that connection. But then I also think, particularly here right now, there's a big disconnect between the sort of community leaders, if you will, both economic development people, political people from on every level, that there's everyone's very glad that the arts are here, but no one particularly goes to them. That everybody's glad that D has, you know, opened up their doors and is bringing 60 to 90,000 people a year to Beacon, but you don't necessarily see those political leaders at DIA. And the same thing with economic development people, that they don't quite get that there's a powerful economic development source. And I think that both falls to them to start to participate, but it also falls to us to be better communicators to those people, because those are the ones who go out of the region and try and brand this region, bring buyers in or bring development in. And so I think that also falls on our side to reach out to them, to those leaders more.
How can we do that?
How many people know who their New York Assembly person is? I think right there is one issue. Mm-hmm. The fact that people other than maybe good people who feel like, yeah, I'm going to vote, and they just go and they vote their party affiliation down because that's how they vote. I think there's a huge disconnect between, you know, how many assemblymen or mayors are on your mailing list, how many economic development people are on your mailing list. So it's a matter of, in terms of the arts community, I think, there's an education from within, and just because you built it doesn't mean that everybody's going to come. And just because you built it, it doesn't necessarily mean that the real players are going to come.
Can I bring up a perversion?
Perversions are always welcome.
Well, one of the things I really, really get off on is bringing somebody who has really brittle competence or exposure to tougher art, and like bringing it to a place like CCX. You know, go from like somebody who's hardly ever, I mean, their concept of, you know, they may know about Picasso or something like that, but to go and see something contemporary and relatively tough. And it's always interesting to me how my predictions of what people are going to respond to are way off. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, for instance, Agnes Martin, I think, is a kind of a tough and pretty absolute painter who I admire quite a bit. Well, this is not a Dia, but I brought a friend of mine who, like, he'd only been to see the Mona Lisa at the Met in, like, 1961. And he grew up in the Bronx, and he really related to those. Hmm. So I think that, you know, I get a lot of spam. I mean, mailing lists is fine, but I think there's a certain point where, you know, we really have to share what we love in a very open and direct and vulnerable way. You know, Dia, the work in Dia is hard. You know, that's sort of up level 8, level 9. You know, like, try to explain some of the, like, even I don't really get a lot of the Judd stuff in there.
Right.
So to sort of bring a mayor through or somebody, like, from that without, like, it can be very intimidating. A person can go out and actually walk into a place like that and not see anything. It just looks like a furniture warehouse. So these are sort of delicate things. And that's also true with collective. I mean, you know, one of the things that's sort of nightmarish to me is somebody buys a work of mine that doesn't really understand it. That's a very difficult thing.
Are you talking about education? That's a whole other thing.
Well, I'm talking about a sort of a thawing the alienation that commerce can throw into this whole process of art, which I could see is very much part of the species nature. To use a very antiquated term, but you know, it's a human thing, and we can throw numbers, and we can talk about clicks, and we can talk about audience and stuff. But you know, this is going to sound very hippie, but it's about connecting.
The flip side of what Benjamin was talking about is some communities do get it up here. You know, the city of Hudson is sponsoring a concert series that we're co-sponsoring with them. They put $5,000 for basically artist fees this summer for 8 concerts that we're co-sponsoring. And every single event, the town officials come out. I mean, mm-hmm. I see them. We talk to them. They are a part of it. They see, I think the city of Hudson political officials see what the arts, there's all kinds of new artists that have moved into Hudson. They see what economic benefits they've gotten from that and are really trying to push that more. And right across the river, the city of Catskill is also seeing what's going on with Hudson and is trying to mimic some of its tactics and try to make the city of Catskill more of an art-centric town. So it is possible. But then we're out in Cairo in mid-Green County, and we've gotten blowback on, like, art is like the new faggot or something in Green County with some local officials. So it kind of runs the gamut.
And also much to the detriment of those officials. I think one of the things that Hudson and Columbia County has going for it, there was a study put out by the Marist Bureau of Economic Research that they put out every year, and basically the arts are the fastest growing industry in Columbia County. Now that's not saying a lot for Columbia County, but Gino, I mean, the city of Hudson, it took them a long time, and there was a lot of work done to get them around there, but they took the bait, and they're starting to understand it. And I think more and more that's you know, those community leaders.
Hopefully they're talking to other community leaders in the Hudson Valley.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to put Sparrow in the car coming up. We riffed a little bit on the idea of, does the middle class buy art anymore? And I'm just going to toss out your direction.
Well, I've been talking to friends of mine who are artists who sell art, you know, like working artists. And a couple of them told me that in the last year and a half, 2 years, middle class and working class people stopped buying art from the recession. That's what they were saying. This one couple I know, Richard Pantel and Karen Whitman, they make etchings. And they're still making just as much money because they're just making bigger things to sell to richer people. But they're sad because they prefer to sell to working class and middle class people, partly because they have politics, partly because I think regular people appreciate art more than collectors who are sort of thinking in terms of money.
Well,
Well, collecting is a hard thing to do. Mm. It takes a lot of courage. Mm. It's not something that I think flows with natural human instinct. I mean, to actually spend money on something that's not very useful, that you can easily put on the wall and have a neighbor come over and go, ha, you bought that. You know, it's hard. And I think despite my misgivings, which I have, I mean, I'm just trying to talk on a very real level about this, it's a hard process. And I think what would be much more, you know, there's only a handful or a few hundred top collectors in the world. It's a very granular thing. I mean, people talk about collectors, but it's not like a continuous blob. It's actual specific people.
Well, I'm a collector, you know, and the most I ever spent, I mean, my typical budget for a piece is a couple hundred bucks, but I've spent up to a couple thousand, and it's not, you know, it's not that I'm brave or anything. I feel it's indulgent. It's like, wow, look, I got a little extra money, and I get to buy this thing that's just so gorgeous, and I want to live with it. So so I don't feel that I'm taking a chance on anything. I'm certainly not buying because I think it's going to be a good investment. So it seems sort of risk-free from my perspective.
Do you ever buy out of fear that you might ever see that thing again?
I've done that.
That's awesome.
Like buy now or lease it.
Hey, Chris, you're selling too.
That's great.
Yeah. See, I wanted to say something about this because, okay, we say nobody's got money; it's a recession. Prada bags are being sold for multi-thousand dollars, okay? We have money for artwork. It's just a matter of where is it that we want to spend our money. And I believe that we are currently in this moment at a point where we're experiencing a renaissance, a redefining of the Hudson Valley and of who the art collectors are and of what kind of money is money that you spend on art. And not only that, but what is art and what is... I mean, you can buy a piece of art for $50. You really can. And the most important thing when you buy a piece of art, instead of being motivated by fear, is being motivated by whatever it elicits within you that makes you want to spend whatever amount you're going to spend on it, whether that be $500 or $5,000. And if your budget allows $5,000, I always say to people, go for it. It makes you feel good. Go for it. I'm happy to make money. Let's do it. You know, like, this is going to be providing something to an artist who's going to get a large portion of this money. This is going to serve everybody that's involved. I'll make my money. You'll be happy. This artist makes money. And let's move forward and figure out and redefine. Whereas, you know, there's only 100 top collectors. Yeah, okay, fine. Not that many people have $100,000 plus to spend every year on artwork. But art is created by all level of people, not just people that make $20,000 collectible works, but people that make $200 collectible works.
Well,
and that's the thing about
American
folk art.
But I think that a lot of the major institutions are sort of geared towards these.
That's all being redefined right now. I feel that it all is all being redefined right now with the introduction of categories like outsider, self-taught, visionary, naive, folk, all these things. You know, not necessarily does everybody have to march through Bard or, you know, wherever they're going to go and get their degree and have somebody say, these are the things, now you're in this clique. And
I applaud the collapse of the existing system.
I think it's fabulous as well. I have no problem with any of it. That's what I'm saying, is like, I think that every artist and every person, we're like flowers. There's all different kinds, there's all different daisies are just as appreciable as roses.
Well, there's also a lot of frustration in the existing network as well.
I'm sure there is. That's why it's being redefined.
I was going to go back to the idea that, you know, the regular folk on the street aren't necessarily buying. And I think that goes back, someone mentioned education. I think it does go back to education. I think right now we're dealing with parents of kids who never had art in their school. So like the parents. Parents now were in public school at a time when arts education was eliminated. So they've never had music. And so therefore, their kids, it's not something that's close to them. And so we have to work on that. And I think schools are getting better at that. I also think there's an issue in terms of buying is look at the art on these walls. And the prices are amazing for what's here. And, you know, right now, there's this culture that we know how to buy a flat screen TV. We go to Best Buy, we talk to a 17-year-old for about 5 minutes, and we give them our credit card, and they ring up $5,000. Uh-huh. And we're going to throw that thing out in 5 years to buy another thing that's a little bit more expensive. So it's not that people don't have money. It's not that people aren't spending money. It's that there's been this disconnect between the art and sort of everyday life. And it sort of starts in the school. And it also, again, I think it goes back to the responsibility of the arts community to start looking out and saying, like, how can we educate the public more in terms of that? So,
yeah, I think, I don't know, thinking about this, I feel like Americans have become a kind of mass culture. And when you buy a Prada bag or whatever company makes a TV, I don't know, Sony, then in a sense you're joining this collective group of people that buy this. You have like brand identity or whatever.
That's
the term
right.
is. And to own something that there's only one of in the whole world,
exactly.
It seems very vulnerable to me. It's frightening. You know, it's lonely. It's overly lonely, I think. For us Americans to just have this one thing, no one else has it.
Well, I've brought up in the past that there is this weird moment with the paint by number craze that opened things up for a brief while. People were touching art, and it was around the same time that you know, the major national newspapers and magazines would run art and art reviews and put artists on the cover, and that's disappeared for quite a few
years.
What
period is this you're talking about?
From the mid-50s up to about 75, say. There's about a 20-year period where it became a little more mainstream design. People were buying posters and other
When I was a kid, you'd watch this TV show and they'd teach you how to paint on the show.
Yeah.
That's right. They still have it.
Yeah. Bob Ross.
But there was more, I think there were more like Sunday artists then. I think it was a hobby like stamp collecting. People were artists. Your aunt.
Frank Sinatra painted a lot.
A lot of those famous.
But at least there was a value to it in the mainstream that they had about television.
But I guess our local version of that are things like Catskill has these cats, and it's quite controversial, but it's brought a lot of people into town and into the galleries, and these events have opened it up, and people are taking their kids to art classes, and they're actually going to openings, and then Hudson started doing dogs, and it's suddenly the scene there.
Kayla wants to do bears.
Really?
That's Kira. That's good. Is that sort of a version of that, you know, John Nagy on TV painting as communities do this?
But that's also, this is where it gets really tricky, because I've seen some of those in not necessarily in Catskill and in Hudson, but I've sort of seen. I saw a recent terrible one in Schwerin, Germany, where basically it was just, they just had these fiberglass animal rhinoceros, and that they, you know, just like there was nothing other than anybody throwing paint on it or the bank like hiring someone to like paint their logo on it. There was no like artistic discussion going on there.
Do you have pictures of these?
And I also feel that the artist community is cooling down on those a little bit. I mean,
it's taking Arts Council's energies to work on all this thing that's basically like the old patronage system, like the Sistine Chapel gets built because the Catholic Church wants it, or, you know, so all these cats get made in Catskill because the Green County Arts Council deems it, and that's where their energy goes, and their energy is not going to the basic infrastructure that needs to happen and the basic artist services that need to happen. You know, I think.
Well, what are some of those elements of infrastructure that are needed right now?
That's a good question.
Modern day Medicis are lacking. Modern day Medicis. That's, you know, there were families, there were people that who had lots and lots of money, and they would hire artists for whatever wages or whatever, you know, they'd fund people.
Has that been taken up by the kind of...
Well, wait a minute, that's Marlies Hessel.
Well, no, I agree. So, okay, you're right. There are a couple.
Okay.
But just, and I'm not disagreeing with the Hessel Museum, though. You know, that's one of the jewels of this region, things that are really forward-thinking and that sort of thing. But these are the things that I think that more and more of these, instead of having to be governmental
things. Social services vying for the same money? Is that what's
social services? Or is,
I mean, as governments moved out of a lot of different areas, does that put a different sort of pressure on the arts and who's buying it?
Well, that's right. That's to find the people who are not affiliated with either a not-for-profit organization or the government to fund things. I mean, universities are the best place to do that. University museums and things like that, because there are people that are either alumnus or something like that, and they build a big center and have big, fabulous things there. But within actual communities.
How many Medicis are in the audience?
I don't think there are any. That's what I'm saying. One. Yay!
So why don't, getting back to you, what are these practical things that maybe we could just write in and say, hey, let's get our money for this, you know? Because everybody here could write a letter. Well, you brought up some things that the cats were draining the blood out of the art money. And
well, I just know that the Arts Council there is spending an exorbitant amount of their time on this project that's kind of like
a PR move
for the city,
and
not necessarily for any artists.
Yeah.
It's about marketing the city and marketing whatever city, of Chicago, the cows and the bulls in New York or whatever.
So how should
the money be spent?
Has to benefit
the artists.
Well, did the WPA programs help the artists or the cities or both?
Both.
Right. And how did that happen?
Because wasn't that a Great Depression thing? Nobody had any money. Everybody was starving and dying, and it was horrible. And all of a sudden, we fund artists, put all sorts of people. I mean, unless I'm wrong. Works Project, what was that called?
Yeah.
Some would argue that it co-opted them politically. But
well, okay. But,
that's a long time ago. I'm still curious, and I don't want to put you on the spot for having raised it, but maybe other people have ideas about where these admittedly limited civic dollars and energies could be going. Should it come time?
As the Arts Council representative?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. And also, to Kay's defense, I have to say that it's the Catskill Chamber of Commerce that's running the event, and Kay sort of facilitates.
But you know, spends a lot of time.
Yeah, yeah.
Going back and forth.
Right. These cat parades, dog parades, they chew up and kill volunteers of all stripes. I think there is a really good point that comes up, and it comes up with Ardalona Hudson, which is the issue of civic development versus cultural development. And I think the artists, when they're developing these kind of programs, have to decide what they're doing it for. Are we creating art or creating an event or creating a program to help the city bring people downtown, or are we creating art?
That's right.
And I think the intention has to be clear before setting out on that adventure, because people get confused. And I think there can be cases where, you know, the town sort of takes it for granted, oh, that the arts will just do this for free. We don't have to fund them, because they'll do those art projects for free. And so I think, the volunteers have to be very clear on that. And, you know, the infrastructure, I mean, I think one of the issues is with small organizations that when they get underfunded, it means that they're understaffed, and you have some very committed people working their fingers to the bone, and then at sort of a diminishing return, because that they can never get past the tipping point where they don't have to work so hard, that it's a slow starvation diet where eating their muscle.
Some people are really getting ground down in the not-for-profit sector.
Yes,
right. And I think that's a couple issues. One is we certainly have to figure out where there is areas of support, but I also think that it means that more more organizations, small organizations, need to start looking for partnerships, or they don't need to beat themselves to a pulp, as it turns out.
But how do people deal with that who are not in the organizations? The single artists, how do they affect a system of that sort? That is, you're talking about institutional, organizational malfunction.
You join the board.
Right. Well, no, I mean, I think it is tough with individual artists, and I think that goes back to building an audience. That is one audience that's here. There's an awful lot of people here. And how do we cultivate more local buyers? And again, I think that's part of it.
Spiro, you've watched the whole scene in Phoenicia, kind of, which has a life of its own, and it has taken on.
But yeah, I just wanted to say, this is, I've been thinking about this for 4 minutes. This is my new theory. This is what we should do with the public money. The public money should be for education to enlarge the concept of who is interested in art. It shouldn't be going to people that are already galleries, organizations. It should be for, like, the real people. So there should be like a van that goes around full of art. It's like the art van. Yeah, and it just brings it to people, and then it comes to these little dusty little towns, comes out, and people go in, they look at the art, they discover what is art. It's nothing for sale. It's just the art discovery van. Anyway, that's my
great.
Actually, there's a library in Cleveland which commissioned a bunch of local sculptors to take all the old books that they were throwing out to make sculptures, which the library then loans out.
Museum in Amsterdam put up has a permanent booth at the airport, has permanent booths at all the train stations.
And the Albany Airport. Albany Airport has very nice local artists.
Very, very well
curated.
Yeah.
Is there a gallery at Stewart Airport? That would be
cool. Susie Lin, who's the new executive director of Orange County, we've been talking about developing a plan in Stewart's in her county, and she's working on it, where, you know, every Hudson Valley county is going to get a different month. So
I think the flip side of the cats, too, that they would make the argument that you're making without the van part, is that they're putting those cats on the street, and people are coming and seeing them when they're going about their business. They're not have to step into an art gallery,
right,
and they have to see them. So I think there's some argument to be made in the, I mean, definitely the cats in Catskill has started a dialogue about art that did not exist before. I mean, there's people criticizing the process, and there's people defending it, and it's in the newspaper every week. And the newspaper in Catskill does not cover art, I mean, in any substantial way. There's listings and things, but this is, so I think there's a flip side to that, and it does go into your
family. Yeah, that's another thing. I forgot that was part of my idea. That what government should do is support bad art. Because the system of, the gallery system is going to bring out the best art. Those people are going to make money and get rich for being good artists. It's
the bad artists that
need support.
There's no guarantee
the
of
government
that.
The government should support, you know, and all the people that are not considered artists, you know, the people that, like, do whittling and, you know, like, what do you call it, make with the embroidery.
Oh, you mean macrame?
Macrame. Yeah. All the hippie arts should be supported by the government.
Because it serves as an entry.
The string art.
You know, on the idea of the art van, I actually do think there is one of the lacks that's been happening, and I see it most with the Poughkeepsie Journal, that where there once was an arts section, it is now called the life section.
Yes.
And art, so therefore, nice. When people start saying, oh, right, you know, art is like, you know, the latest pocketbook. It is this extra thing. It isn't something that's part of our lives. And not only is there not an art section anymore, but then there's a huge shedding of any arts writers. And so, in fact, there's no one talking intelligently on an ongoing basis. That, you know, the weekly news, the daily, nightly news will have 5 minutes spent on sports, and there'll be no conversation about art at all. Maybe there's a conversation about the movie, but then it's a sort of a flash in the pan about Star. There isn't actually a conversation. So one of the issues is, as a public, when we go to DIA, we don't have the vocabulary for the approach. When we come in, you know, so I think that's a version of the art van. It's like all the newspapers.
But that's also where by coming into the letters columns of the papers forces the dialogue to enter into the public.
But it's I think the critic is an important thing that we're losing. And I don't mean like
the part of the editors don't like the critics anymore.
Right, and I don't miss, when I say critic, I don't mean the person who comes and says, poof, you're good, poof, you're bad. You know, a critic who actually has some kind of intelligence, who actually adds to the artistic discussion. And that's a very rare form of critic. But I think that's one of the sort of areas of the public square where art isn't discussed anymore. And so that's another reason why I think it's not...
Brian, you've been in a number of different venues. How has this changed in each of the different places you've worked?
So here, Philadelphia, Seattle, Boston, each has a sort of semi-thriving alternative press. The alternative press in Seattle was by far the most robust. I don't think that was just a function of the then booming economy. There were a variety of reasons, including the youth of the city that supported, and not so young doesn't mean better and more sophisticated. It tends to mean more disposable income. And so there was a perception among the advertisers who advertised in the weekly press that there was an audience for a weekly, thoughtful, accessible piece of writing about a current show at a museum, house, artist studio, park, what have you. I mean, that was, and it's not just sort of, you know, nostalgia for what is approaching 10 years ago. That was a very thriving scene. And there was, I noticed a direct connection between some of the press that particular exhibitions received and the audience that we would get at the museum. Philadelphia is quite a different situation. It's a much older, much more jaded city with an excess of press outlets that also, by the time I was working in Philly, the web had become the sort of de facto source for up-to-the-minute news about art, so the print medium mattered less. Here, I don't know. I don't know how people found out about this today. I don't know how... dealers and nonprofits address this question of the hideous cost of trying to promote a single exhibition. I mean, it's literally thousands of dollars. You know, we have probably surprisingly small amount of money to spend on marketing every year. You know, it's five figures, which sounds like a lot of money, but when you think about the area the museum is trying to reach, it's not a lot of money. We're trying to figure out, and I wonder whether other organizational people are, how this is being dealt with. We're trying to figure out whether we should be talking about the museum, the museum, the museum, or this show, this show, this show. And it's particularly interesting to me because I see, and many people see, the museum in New Paltz as presenting a fairly diverse array of exhibitions and programs. But along comes next July, whatever, a loan show of Hudson River School paintings from the New York Historical Society, and it's like, you know, that's it. That's all we're promoting. That's all we can talk about. And there's no room in the calendars we buy. There's no room on the radio time we're going to buy. There's no room in the president's speech to the faculty on Friday about anything other than what is essentially a loan show of Hudson River School paintings. So I'm curious about how organizations of all kinds are trying to sell themselves to
the public.
A
good tagline,
yeah.
I think, is really important. like the good tagline. This is something you probably noticed recently. Every press release that I send out says, the Varga Gallery represents self-taught outsider and visionary artists in Woodstock, New York, blah, blah, blah. So there's that tagline that goes on to the end of absolutely every press release that I send out that says, this is what we do. So my thing with the Dorsky would be like, the Dorsky does, and then, you know, and then have that as part of every press release so that you really solidify it in the minds of people that are reading it, even if it's just the press who define what it is that they send out. Because even you wrote something, and it said, I remember reading it, you said in it, and she has defined herself as. And I was like, aha, it's finally getting there where you crystallize what people perceive you as so that you're not appealing to everybody. You're appealing to that thing. You're saying, this is what we do. If you're interested in this, come here. And then you can have shows that appeal perhaps outside of that or that highlight aspects of, like, for instance, the East Village Lower East Side show that just opened last night, Slamming. And that, I mean, were those people self-taught outsider and visionary artists? Not necessarily, but that as part of something that I'm doing, like this really strongly curated show that is something that I'm doing in a gallery that focuses on that sort of people and thinking of them as like renegades and that sort of thing, you know, pioneers in a small art market, you know, the East Village, the Lower East Side, even though it's a fabulous, everybody came out of there and all these great people, but just saying that this is what I do and look how fabulous, this is this fabulous exhibition and then this is what I do and this is this fabulous exhibition. So every time you put out something, you're solidifying what it is that you're defining yourself as.
Norm, you worked in that great business and you've been very good with, I mean, just the idea of funism as kind of wrapping together all these different projects that you have. Is this possible on a larger basis? Is this possible beyond just a gallery or just one artist's work in a gallery to kind of brand an entire area for a time?
I think every branding dream is possible with enough funding for starters.
Or a big enough mouth.
Big enough mouth. You know, I mean, that's what I always think is, first off, is what's the budget? You know, do you have enough of a budget to sort of plant the seed in people's minds that this, like the Hudson Valley art scene, say, equals this? And I think if you don't, then just don't even spend $1 but try the big enough mouth route.
If you keep saying it, then people, it's like advertising. This is the reason, you know, like Prada's doing so well. The whole, I came out of a school, we were taught how it is that you make someone think something you want them to think. You know, that's what advertising is. It's saying, we want you to get these $200 Reeboks. Why? I mean, do you really need to wear, you know, $200 worth of foot gear in order to get around? No, they're telling you what they want you to do. So they keep repeating it, and they keep saying it over and over. And eventually your mind, your subconscious just, oh, my God, okay, I need my Prada bag, you know, or I need to be best friends with Paris Hilton or whatever. You know, like all of a sudden you're trained by somebody completely outside of your actual realm of existence to believe that you need to participate in the Sony TV high def whatever. You know, as opposed to owning your own little individual something that nobody else has. This piece by Stacy Flint. You know, yay! Oh my God, nobody else has this. This is an original. I've got this. And, you know, parading that around as opposed to your, you know, whatever, your ring or your necklace or your haircut, you know, which is ephemeral.
So this is probably like the unanswerable question, but how, I mean, clearly there's an amount of self-confidence involved in espousing this view that to buy a unique work
belief,
of art.
Strong belief.
Well, right. So how, without being sort of full of contempt for the person who's a sucker and buys a flat panel display, and
no, they're not a sucker. They're just simply, you know.
Okay. So, all right. So
buying, I mean, their TV.
This is a big hinge here. How do you work that divide between what we're sort of characterizing as people who are the victims of a you know, mass media hoax versus the few and enlightened who like the stuff we like?
Redefining necessities.
Yeah,
redefining necessities.
You've thought a lot about this.
Well, it also seems like the remedy is just more of the same tactics that got people to buy the flat screen TV to begin with.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Marketing.
Which I have a whole problem with that remedy.
Do you think your TV's crisper now that you're looking at it through HD Lindsay,
I would think that Robert wouldn't have a TV.
You don't have to. See, we don't do it either. It seems silly to me.
Well, I have an old, old TV that I look at weird VHS tapes.
Yeah.
And I have a flat screen. But I kind of want to root for the introvert for a second. I mean, you know, there's all this stuff, sell, promote, everything. It's like, what about, why are we making this stuff?
You just continue making it, and the people who have the business of selling it will sell it for you if they're doing their job.
But an artist's job is not.
Yeah, but I know, I'm also an artist.
How do you deal with that? Because I always found it to be very hard.
I find that every person is, when you're making art, you're making something out of nothing. That's what I always say. You're making something, you're taking different things and you're putting them together. And every person has a creative expression, and everybody's is valuable. For, you know, like even the thing that you think sucks, and somebody, you know, spent 3 days making whatever, there's somebody out there in the world floating around that loves it. And so to instead of like say, oh, this artist is bad, this artist is good, you know, there's different people that would appreciate different pieces of art. And instead of saying, well, all the people that will appreciate this suck, and these are the ones that are really great, look at people as appreciating different strata of art. And, you know, something is right for someone and something is right for another person. Somebody wants to put country, shabby chic in their house, and another person wants a Van Gogh that he had to spend $20 million
on. There's also a whole huge category of art that is not object-based at all.
Well, yeah, and conceptual. I understand that, too.
Or performance art and stuff all of like it. That. And I think, actually, that's a whole category of work that I think really needs...
But valuing it as a creative...
Tom?
And most of the work, the artists that we deal with are not creating objects.
Yes! But they're creating an experience. They're creating an experience.
Yeah.
At this point, I'm going to open it up to the audience. If there's yes.
I'm thinking about the Hudson Valley farmers who are recreating a whole new kind of merchandise. It's buy local, it's eat fresh, it's eat what your neighbors create.
That's right.
And we are producers of the most... the highest probably percentage of money that goes back into the community because it's made from nothing here and sold by local people, and it's not like we have a store that where we're importing something from China and selling it and then the profits are going to, you know, Dayton, Ohio or something. So I think that's one hook that would be a great merchandising hook, and get neighbor to know neighbor.
Macrobiotic art buying.
Yeah.
Buy in your community.
A big stamp on every art piece.
Yeah. Made in the Hudson Valley.
We're working on that.
Yeah.
We're working on that.
Good.
This artwork does not travel more than 25.
Yeah,
years.
Right?
I think there's a really big difference between how you cultivate selling art of individual people and how you impact a whole community about all of the arts. And the latter is a bigger effort and a wider effort, but will include the smaller one. And so the more that we do things to provide easily accessible paths for the average person to experience and enjoy and learn about any kind of art, whether it's, you know, music, dance, theater, media, sculpture, painting, whatever, then they're going to be more open and more interested in other things. And so, in my view, our job as arts administrators, as those institutional people, you know, it is to cultivate the ground, you know, to use an analogy with the farming, cultivate the ground and do a lot of small things so that we can find a path where people can experience and enjoy art in a context that's not intimidating to them. And that the more that we go to them, and the more they have a good time, and the more they see their kids having a good time, and the more information we provide them about what else they can do, you know, to me, that's
the
more
than that. There seems to me that there was a question here about the WPA and the Depression area, and If you look at the recent past history, the last 30 years, the arts have been used to transform communities all across the country. Okay? Perhaps it's the time now to reverse that trend that has been taken for granted. That is that the arts are there to transform communities. The question is, how do you make the arts part of everybody's life, and at the same time, how do you provide a livelihood for artists as artists, so they don't have to be doing something else, okay? So the question is, how do you sell the artists and the arts to everybody else in everyday life? Reverse the process. Show that if I am a homeowner and I'm building a new home and I want to have the latest technology through my walls or to show the latest HD TVs or high-screen TVs, everything else, suddenly the artists in the community that can come and do the work for me. Because who better than artists that are in the medium of film, video, productions, etc., to come and do that for me. They will understand what I need. If I'm decorating my home, instead of going to the IKEA catalog, tell me that there are artists in the community that will come to my home and will look at the ambience and will tell me, you know what? There are two or three artists here in the Hudson Valley that will really go well with what you already have. And you can do this and that. So it's a matter of reversing a little bit what has been taken for granted, is that the arts transform communities. Let the communities be transformed by the arts. Now, who's going to do that selling? I mean, who are the logical organizations to do the selling? The arts councils. The arts councils have the resources to really push for that. And the same that it has been promoted for so many years, that the arts transform communities, let the arts councils, let the arts organizations, let the art galleries that have an influence on people, okay, start telling them, you know what, the next time that you need to remodel your house, come to us, because there are several artists that will give your house that unique view that will make it even more valuable. Because here it's a matter of value. It's a matter of value, it's a matter of prestige, it's a matter of so many different things. Why do we buy the latest TV? Because we want to be in the cutting edge. But artists can give us that cutting edge too, if that's what we promote, if there is a concerted effort to promote that. I think that if we start doing it on a consistent basis, then you are going to transform the whole cycle. And suddenly you are going to have artists doing work for which they are being paid accordingly to what they deserve.
Before I step back there, it's thorough.
Yeah, I just want to say, it's a good idea, and I think also people should bring in poets to teach them how to talk.
Real critical coverage of the arts. And somebody else brought up the fact, how do people come here today? How do we communicate these connections? And we're talking about the internet. Now, I came here today because I got an email from Carl Brown at 1:30 this afternoon that told me about this, and this was interesting to me, so I made a drive down from Rosendale to come here for this today. People will come if they get that communication, and I think that what is happening right now, the newspapers are all going down. They're all writing down. They don't have a budget to support critical arts anymore. But what is going on is the internet. So how do we develop that? Now, Duchess has got a website that deals with a weekly newsletter. I don't know what other, I tap into that particular one. I think that that's something that we should all build on. Now, wouldn't it be great to have a place where we could dialogue and continue the discussions that we've been having today, but talking as artists, talking as collectors, talking as curators, talking as critics, and having that continue and evolving. You see, it's a simple thing, an event that happens like this in one place and then then it kind of disappears off, and we don't know quite what happens there, and, you know, who's doing what where. How can we continue that? How can we...
I think it's great that Tom's here, and this will be, today will be available online, tonight or tomorrow?
Today, I'll get it up, yeah.
And so then it becomes something that can be passed on in its entirety, and that's a start. But you worked, I mean, your whole art form is working in kind of the idea of passing things around. So
yeah, we try to web stream live almost any event that we do, and we hook up with other people that are doing events and web stream them, and I think that's more and more the future of all the arts. Is if there's gonna any way, you know, it's a little harder with sculpture or maybe with your books to really get the same idea across through a little screen or a little sound file, but more and more that it is definitely a way to interconnect and find out. I don't know if the Arts Councils can interconnect somehow, because we get great listings from the Greene County Arts Council. I don't know if there's a way to get them all working together so that we could find out all about stuff throughout the Hudson Valley more quickly.
Well, there's something I found on YouTube that was amazing. Like, I was trying to go to some of the Bowery galleries, and I, you know, now I'm live up here, so I'm a tourist in the city, and just trying to figure out how to see. There's some guy running around taking pictures of all this stuff.
There's a lot of bloggers.
And all the shows and stuff on YouTube, so I could go. And instead of, like, not going to go see stuff, it made me interested in going to see stuff. You know, like, a lot of times the low-res media is the draw. Mm-hmm. And you know what would be kind of neat if we had is some kind of portal. Because the trouble is a lot of people have meaningless, a lot of people stuff, but I don't know how to hook up into anything. I mean, what is it, Craigslist, Hudson, New York, or... Mid-Hudson Valley? I mean,
they don't have...
Yeah, there's a thing... There's an entity like that going on in the Oneonta area called What's Up. And it's just it's an email kind of newsletter that goes out. And it's gotten pretty wide at this point. Yeah. And it pulls everything together up there. And it's very low format and easy to deal with and read and hold on to. And maybe that's... And some things around here are so heavy that they'll...
I mean, it's a great idea. There's another tool, and I'm going to throw this out there. There's a thing called Artsopolis, and it's a very web dynamic sort of marketing, community building, arts, cultural product that a number of communities have. I think Minneapolis has it, San Diego has it. And I actually ask you all to go and find it and look at it, and if you're interested in it, let me know. Because that's certainly something that we would be happy to do. I also say one of the challenges of the Hudson Valley is, and New York State, is political boundaries. And as much as we want to be, you know, regional, from Greene through Ulster, Sullivan, Rockland, from northern Westchester up through Putnam, Dutchess, Columbia, there, we are juggling this idea that Dutchess County is one of our major benefactors, and so we have to be very careful about where our resources go. But there are more and more talks that are regional, and we hope to be cracking that nut, shortly.
It's difficult. I'm sure that I've been talking about things that are not of interest to anybody here because they don't get up to Greene County very often, and they're more interested in Dutchess events. So it's the area is so spread out. I mean, it's all like we're the Hudson Valley, but it's so spread out that, you know, I don't get down here that often. You guys don't get up there that often. It's kind of difficult.
Here's the question. It is totally spread out, but also what you were saying is that Dutchess County is a major benefactor, but doesn't it feel like the audience in Dutchess County is one of the more fragmented toward the arts than, say, Ulster or some of the other places where there's more people that at least go to the openings regularly? Am I correct or not?
I don't understand when you say Dutchess audience fragmented. What does that mean?
Well, there's more funding for the arts in Dutchess. Dutchess where? Poughkeepsie? Because that's where the Dutchess County...
We're pan-Dutchess, and we also distribute state money in Ulster County, and now we've been doing Ulster County money in Ulster County.
Right.
So, okay. But yes, there's more money in Dutchess.
But isn't there more money for the arts, which is distributed in various places? But isn't there kind of a song in Poughkeepsie or Dutchess or whatever that enough people don't come to the openings? There's not enough, you know. And even though the Poughkeepsie Journal is there and there's coverage, but isn't there, you know, galleries can't stay open and.
Yeah, I mean, I think different communities throughout the Hudson Valley have different strengths and challenges. Do you know that Poughkeepsie has a very strong performing arts, both nonprofit and commercial. And the visual arts have a greater challenge to build that audience there. And I think, you know, there are all kinds of reasons for that, including really bad urban development in the 1950s, and racism that still lingers, which prevents a lot of people from exploring downtown Poughkeepsie, though Kingston has solved that for the most part. Kingston, you know, has a very vibrant visual arts scene, as does Woodstock, as does Beacon, where the performing arts aren't as strong as.
But how does the money get to Dutchess County Council for the Arts? Is it New York State grants that money?
You know, in terms of funding, right. Dutchess County has been supporting the arts nicely for a while. It can do better, obviously. Ulster County has not been as much investing in the visual arts. In Dutchess County, we've also had a United Arts Fund, which is a community-wide funding program, which has given strength to the arts organizations in Dutchess County that Ulster County has not. But the state is the same on both sides in all counties.
Just to kind of to wrap it up at this point, just so that as kind of an ending note to ask of everyone here, just kind of. Has any of this, in terms of audience or funding for the arts or the institutional scene, has that had any effect on the actual making of art? Or does that just kind of continue on its own? Are we talking about herding cats here?
There is
an ecology, and I kind of wish it was someone who I think has interesting ideas is David Ross. I don't know if he still has a house here. Mm-hmm. And he used the term ecology of art. And I think there is a feedback mechanism from institutions. And it affects me, because it's like, how do I direct my work, you know? I make certain things that are designed more for a mass audience, and I make some really different things that are more designed for, actually, more or less web presence, because the physical object is so fragile. And there's some things I make that are really designed to be just stumbled on in the woods by, you know, they're not promoted at all. So there's a definite feedback loop, and I think one thing that would be helpful to anybody in this is to kind of get a better idea of how to work with some of these different institutions. It can be kind of intimidating, and if you didn't come through this, you don't have any idea at all. I mean, it's taken me decades to get some sense of this.
Does it feel healthier than the Lower East Side?
Well, that was a whole different game. And at that time, when I was down there, I had a very nihilistic idea of civilization. I didn't know it would even last the next week. So the first week I was there, there was a riot. And I thought, wow, this is a great place. I love it here. You don't get so many of those up here. But I'll tell you one thing that was funny about that neighborhood is there was so much downward pressure that we kind of learned how to really share and cooperate, and it kind of created a kind of weird kind of almost combat kind of camaraderie. And I thought a lot of your ideas are really beautiful, and I think that,
and it's easy to implement because every one of us, every artist in the Hudson Valley, start talking to other people, and we tell them, if you know somebody that is doing something at home, by the way, have you thought of an artist to do this?
Well, give you
add value, it will add, and if the council's promoting, if your organization's promoting, you start creating what you were telling before, that is a message that you repeat, and you repeat, mm-hmm. and you repeat.
Okay, let's pretend there's no IRS here, okay? There's a lot of parts of the art economy that have nothing to do with money. I mean, for instance, this morning, I really need to get a bunch of scans done. I just talked to a friend of mine who has access to a scanner, so, okay, I'll trade work for it. And, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, one of the things that happens to a lot of artists is they get kind of hot and they make some high-ticket sales, and then something changes and then you can't sell your work. And you're in this weird thing where you owe money to the IRS, and I'm fantasizing. I'm not in this position. the point of it is that, you know, you're out there, and there maybe it's easy. You know, the Vogels had an amazing collection that they developed by cat-sitting for people like Christo and stuff. And it was an incredible collection that was done. I don't think they spent more than $300 per piece. And I think a lot of people forget that you can really score some major stuff on the cheap, you know?
Yeah.
Brian, is it looking healthy around here these days? You see a lot of art and there are in the studios and around and color from the area.
I don't know how to answer that question.
Do you see shifts in the work, or is it just a constant activity of discovery?
For me, it's still a period of discovery. I guess just quickly, I would say that I'm curious about the, and we can't even get into it now because of the time and temperature, but this business of post 9/11 sort of flight from New York. The idea that, you know, I just heard in the crowd, we live here to escape from the riots that happen in the city. I mean, I wouldn't associate myself with that necessarily. I also know a lot of artists in Beacon who are struggling currently with a sort of, you know, post-David Ross phenomenon in the school building here. It's ups and downs. I mean, the very fate of the postponed sight lines, I think, is indicative of the fact that, and maybe it will always be this way, maybe it's always been this way, that there's always something about to happen here. I mean, you know, the sort of mythological first art colony at Birdcliff, as full of problems as it was, you know, lasted arguably 6 or 8 years, and then really turn itself inside out and manage to struggle on for maybe 20 more years. And that's looked upon now in certain circles as this incredibly significant touchstone. I don't know what that has to do other than defining through a negative with what the scene is like today. It's a long way of saying I don't know. But I mean, yeah.
Norm, has it been very, very good up here?
Personally, it's been awesome up here. It's been great for me. I mean, I got 3 kids, and I just love having them here. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of making my art, it's just been great to do it here. I love everything about where I live. In terms of sort of today's topic, like creating a Hudson Valley art scene, sort of a branded art scene, I think this kind of discussion and this kind of a show and the Sightlines Art Fair, Hudson Valley, you know, art fair is just is a great start, and branding it somehow with a good tagline and good word of mouth, it's all good stuff. In terms of the audience, I guess I feel sort of less optimistic. The audience can be turned into people who view art more or collect art more. I think the audience is what it is, and they can be brought in by like the cats and Catskills. I mean, the power of public art, I think, is just huge. But in terms of like really changing the audience, I'm slightly less optimistic.
Christina, you deal with a lot of different audiences. Are they responding?
I'm selling more art than I've ever sold in the 5 years that I've had my gallery now. And I have, in the course of the 5 years that I've had my gallery, am striving to constantly raise the bar of the caliber of artists that I'm showing so that there's a reason for people to come. And I intersperse those shows, like the graffiti show that I had last year. I did an annual. I did a second annual graffiti show. Last year I sold $16,000 worth of artwork out of it. That was good enough reason to say, let's try that again next year. And, you know, depending on how this show does, there's a lot more. I'm positioning myself to be a reason to come here, to bring artists from the city and make there a reason to come to my gallery and a reason to spend money. You know, putting something out there that's got a history of people buying this guy's work for $10,000, $15,000, whatever, you know, or that he's, like Fuck You, for instance, major East Village artist currently in my show, F-A-Q. He is really one of the quintessential East Village artists, and to have him in my gallery is an honor to me. You know, I find that I respect artists so much that when I have an artist whose work I love, it is an honor to me that they are showing in my gallery and that they will do that, and then I do my best to sell their work. And I feel that I know we're in it. Really crappy economy, and I know things are really bad, but it doesn't seem to be coming through in my sales, so there must be something happening, you know? Maybe the money is shifting. Where people are spending their money is shifting, and people's perception about what they want to spend money on is shifting.
Who's that fellow? He was Andy Warhol impersonating?
Alan Majette.
I think I maybe ran into him once, and he told me that there was a wormhole between the Lower East Side and Woodstock.
Let me just tell you, I didn't want to say this because my mom would just melt in her seat right now, but I do feel that this region is a great region to ride out the apocalypse. No matter what's coming, you know, like hurricanes, storms, New York City floods, whatever. There's a reason we are all drawn to this Hudson Valley region. These mountains, I do believe there are vortexes. I think Woodstock is major. I don't think that in like the, oh my God, you know, we were so
all my friends and I live in the Lower East Side, we were hoping for the apocalypse.
Right, exactly. But now you're here. And now you'll get it.
Just
pretty soon.
Tom,
will you be able to broadcast the apocalypse?
Yes. Yes.
So this is Edgeside C.
I don't think so, actually, because the radio waves will go.
But not the internet necessarily.
Probably.
Yeah, maybe.
I want to say something.
Okay.
I think that all of us have a piece of reason, and we have to put it together and blend it, like a branding, education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that we are all pieces and all together empowering individually and in the community. But we all have a piece of, you know, and respect. For everybody's, I mean, you like it or not, respect and empowering and education all together in the blender. And I think that, you know, we are putting a piece of voice, each of us. And I believe that the selling, you know, is possible.
Sure.
You have to not be afraid to sell. Also.
That's right.
Younger generations are really wonderful.
A lot of 30-somethings buying art.
You know, and also the younger artists are better than, you know, oh, yes, I don't want to sell, yes, I want to sell. Just, you know, let the gallery or yourself, your studio, and, you know, without really feeling, you know, any kind of situation about it. I think that if we do it, it's fine that we sell it or get funded in any way possible.
Well,
if you do conceptual grants or whatever, you know,
One thing I found really strange when I first moved up here is, like, particularly in Kingston,
people were
kind of down on themselves. Like, the old town, well, this is Kingston, it's kind of frumpy. And I think that it's world class. I mean, I think people should really lift their expectations up and think on an international global level.
Couldn't agree
anything.
More. Absolutely.
And I, you know, to what Paul said, I think feeds into that is that there has been progress and things are looking up. And progress, I think, as doom and gloom as we can talk, I do think there has been progress. I think if we look at you know, there's a turnaround in arts businesses in all the major cities along the Hudson River, but, you know, just in Beacon alone in the last year, 5 new galleries opened. So there's always 2 steps forward, 1 step back, and I think Dia coming in, believe me, from someone who was involved with the art scene 35 years ago, though I don't remember too much about it then, There has been progress, and there is a greater awareness of the arts in the Hudson River Valley. And with things like DIA, and with things like the Fisher Center, as well as, you know, the other organizations, including the Center for Photography in Woodstock, or the Powerhouse Theater at Vassar, or Hudson.
MPAC is about to open.
Right. RPI. And that all of a sudden, Hudson Valley is beginning to be in the... Hudson Valley art scene is actually getting in the international press, national
mm-hmm.
international
press. Well, you know what gets a lot of international press, which is weird, is Woodbury Commons.
That is true.
Roadblock and just steer those people up a little bit further up the river.
Or put an art photo right there.
And just get them in, because
Henrietta.
You know, that's a good idea, but I think that art is being the but we don't really, people are curious about artists, but artists are scary. Right. How can we become less scary to this new market? Okay. And there's a way to open up, and we know that snobism has ruled the gallery.
Yeah.
And it gets off to the artist. I mean, even as an artist, you feel awed to go, not awed, but scared to go into a gallery because you're not treated. And we have to stop that. The artist have to open up to people. People want to know, a lot of people want to know, what are you doing and how do you do that and why are you thinking that? They don't have to love it, but they just have to feel more comfortable with the artist and the art world.
I'm going to ask Spira if you have any, just as a final statement, and we'll wrap up with it.
Well, I just wanted to say that each one of us really is a work of art. We're like a walking work of art. And I think we each need to work on ourselves, just go home today, and improve yourself as an individual work of art, and that will transform the Hudson Valley.
Yes! Yes!
Remember, just don't vote for him for president. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yay. Yeah. Woo! I'm stuck to my seat. That was...